I'm Jennifer Hambrick, midday host of Classical 101, WOSU Public Media in Columbus. I'm speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning composer William Balcom, who joins me by phone from his home in Michigan. Your music is noted for, among other things, its breadth of styles.
They're all slightly different, and they may be more different. Some of them are much more simple and tonal, some of them are quite complex, because of the meanings that are involved. Now, the difference between spoken language and musical language, as we found over time, is that a spoken language, you know, you're talking about a book and you point to a book. What you do is you find the function by actually playing the music and dealing with it, and after a while, it takes on the meaning that you want it to have. And so certain things are very settled in their meanings, and other things are still being explored.
You are known for composing works that, in many cases, blur the boundaries between so-called art music and popular music.
Oh, yes.
So this was a conscious aesthetic decision for you.
Yes. It seems to me that this was something that was, in a way, almost a reaction against the art for art's sake versus the totally pop for pop's sake kind of situation we have now an awful lot. If you look at the old masters from the beginning, the ones who really have expanded the whole palette of music, you have to find that they will have at times turned their attention to popular sources around them to be able to expand into, first of all, a larger audience, but also a more direct kind of meaning. There's always been this interface between the two until there was made a kind of a schism someplace in the 19th century between art, music, and that other stuff. So
sure.
What I try to do is to repair the breach.
You are known for your contributions to ragtime, the rags that you yourself have composed, and also your recordings of rags by earlier ragtime composers. Could you talk about this particular genre, ragtime? What about it speaks to you, how you view it in the context of American music, and where you think your own rags take the genre?
Well, you never know what the effect of whatever you're doing is going to be over time or even to other people, but I will say one thing for me. It was a kind of liberation from the conformism of the art music, which was so prevalent in the 1950s and 60s in Europe and here. I began to see some kind of ways I could connect, you know, historical music with new music, which was anathema in those days, because especially in Europe, people really wanted to push the past out of the way. But anyway, here I am being sort of a little bit at sea about what to do with myself, because I had these two sides. I was already working on something kind of vernacular, a little thing that was called Dynamite Tonight, an opera for actors, which is sort of like World War I popular music. That's one side. The other side was me playing and writing in a very difficult chromatic style. And people would ask me, which one do you want to do? And I was a little tortured about how to answer this and also for myself. Years later, I was teaching for 1 year at the University of Washington, in 65, 66 about then. And they told me to go and interview John Cage at the local Pacifica radio station, which I did. We talked for about 3 hours about this and that and, you know, very deep philosophical things. And then he said, well, how about you? Where are you? He says, well, I'm a bit conflicted. And then he said something that opened my eyes. Some people divide the world into things that are good and things that are bad. Others take it all in and let their inner organism decide. Scales fell off my eyes. I suddenly realized I could do what I wanted. And that gave me the latitude to get involved with whatever I got interested in. And by pure chance, I got involved with somebody at the Queen's College where I was teaching for a couple of years with the jazz course. And somebody had told me about an opera by Scott Joplin. Nobody knew in the classical world who he was. And I mean, my friend, who's Norman Lloyd, said, well, he wrote Maple Leaf Rag, and he wrote this opera called Tremonition. And I said, you know, this sounds funny. I think I'll try to hunt it up. So I went to the Library of Congress. I went to the Lincoln Center, and I went to the County Colon Library uptown in New York. And nobody had it. So one day I stopped at the office at Queens College, and we had 3 desks and 10 people on the door. I had a drawer to myself, and this fellow came in who would teach the jazz course named Rudy Blesch. And I said, Mr. Blesch, I'm trying to find a score of Tremonition. He says, I have one at home. So we brought it the next week, and I was fascinated by it. And he said, he wrote wonderful rags. And his friend Max Morath had put together a little publication of all kinds of ragtime. And I bought this copy of 100 Rags. Actually, Max gave it to me. Max Morath was very prominent in the restoration of ragtime. I took them home, and I played them through, and I was in love with ragtime. And the next thing I know, I felt like writing it. And a friend of mine, William Albright, who was living here in Ann Arbor, I was still in New York, he wrote them too, so we would send them to each other, almost like chess problems, in the mail. And that all sort of grew into a whole bunch of composers who started to write rags. It was a liberation from the having to sound modern all the time.
One of your most significant works in terms of scale and other factors as well is your oratorio, Songs of Innocence and of Experience. I've read that this work really summarizes your personal philosophy. Is that true? And if so, how so?
Partly because the final resolution of the Songs of Innocence, actually, I added one of the poems that he had actually engraved, A Divine Image, which is an angry poem that goes, cruelty has a human heart, jealousy a human face. Partly because, to me, it was not because I'm angry, but also because that's part of the human condition, too. We've been through such terrific horrors in the last century, so that we would probably be able to understand that this is part of the human character, that we should take that into account. We'll only be able to understand and deal with it if we can accept that that's part of us. So what I was really trying to do was to give a picture of the whole human panoply of feelings, of all the things that Blake touches on.
What would you say are the strongest influences, musical and otherwise, on your work as a composer?
You know, I'd be the last person to tell you. I don't know. All I know is something actually influences me some way, but by the time it comes through me, it comes out another way, so I'm not quite sure where the source is always.
I'm Jennifer Hambrick, midday host of Classical 101, WOSU Public Media in Columbus. I've been speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning composer William Baulkham on the occasion of his 80th birthday.